Welcome to the Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, that music always gets me pumped up to start this podcast.
How could it not? We usually don't hear the music on the front end when we do it, though. So, you know, you should be especially amped up now that you've heard it.
I'm very amped up. Our editor, producer, Lindsay Fulton, she just decided just now to start playing it at the beginning so we could actually hear it. And I'm ready to go take the field. Put me in, coach.
All right, Stu. So that is the pep talk you needed. It's going to take this podcast to the next level. Although, as we say that, I do think we owe our audience a big thank you because we have seen some numbers and we've seen a pretty significant bump in subscribers since when, Stu?
Since the beginning of the season. It turns out that all those times I said, if you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe, people actually listened. People actually did it. Thank you. Thank you very much, everybody. Great growth this season. In terms of what's going on in college football right now, a crazy, crazy story on Tuesday. Bruce, I was at Starbucks, as I often am working during the day. I had just gotten there and I checked my phone. And it's just one of those things where sometimes you happen to check email at the exact moment that something comes in. And it comes in and it says, it's from Wake Forest, and it says investigation in the subject line. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there was an NCAA investigation. We didn't even know about it. Mm-mm. I had forgotten about the thing at Louisville with the game plan that discovered. So I'd forgotten about that, and I open it up, and I couldn't believe what I'm reading. That the school, that Wake Forest itself, is saying, we've done an investigation, we figured it out. Our own radio broadcaster, a former coach, a former player there, was leaking information to the other two opponents, and he's been doing it since 2014. It's nuts.
Yeah, you know, it's weird because you and I had talked offline a little bit about what we thought might, you know, could be in the works when the way it was worded as a breach of information, right? It was just kind of a head scratcher. And then to hear the what happened. Now, I'll say this. I actually know Tommy Elrod decent. I didn't know him when he was a coach at Wake Forest, but 3 years ago, it was actually my first assignment at Fox. I covered the ACC media days. I was supposed to go interview Jameis Winston and Jimbo Fisher and Bobby Petrino, ironically enough, for America's Pregame and Fox Sports Live. And at one of the lunches, Tommy Elrod came over to me and sat down and we talked. And I think he had told me he had read one of my books. And, you know, we just kind of talked for like 20 minutes and, you know, we kind of stayed in touch a little bit. I talked to him a handful of times once, you know, Jim Grobe, who's his mentor, had got back into coaching at Baylor. So when I saw this, I was like, whoa, this is, you know, maybe do a double take because I actually, like I said, I know the guy. I can't say like, you know, I know him that well, but I definitely would say I know him. I've talked to him a handful of times this year. So it was just kind of, it was an eye opener. And then, you know, I saw, you know, some folks connect, you know, trying to connect the dots and with staffers at places that guys he used to work with at Wake Forest who are now at other places who had faced Wake Forest. It's an intriguing story and I'm curious to see, you know, what the motive, you know, if there'll be more information out there about why this actually happened.
All right. Well, let's piece together the timeline of events here. Tommy Elrod played at Wake Forest in the 90s. He, like you said, Jim Grobe was his mentor. I believe he started as a GA and worked his way up. Jim Grobe gets fired in 2013, and Elrod does not get retained by Dave Clawson, the new coach. He then moves over and becomes the radio analyst. Is it as simple, do we think, as he had an axe to grind and he wanted to undermine the coach who didn't keep him?
I don't know. I mean, right now it could be anything. You know, I saw people speculating like what else could he have possibly had to gain by doing this? You know, beyond
well,
that.
Well, it depends. One big factor in that is was he just giving this information away or was he selling it? Was he making money off of
right.
it? Did he need the money?
Right.
Did he have gambling debts? Did he? I mean, the possibilities are endless. I'm sorry to make light of this, but I just find this story to be more amusing than I do like, I don't have any hot takes to give you about this. I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah, well, the question then is, what's the next step? Does the ACC end up, you know, investigating it further to see, you know, what happens on the other end of this. Because if that's the case, you know, I mean, where does this fall on the category of gamesmanship? You know, like there was a lot of talk this year about sign stealing and signal stealing is okay, but it's within limits. Obviously, this would seem like it would cross another threshold above and beyond what's right. considered gamesmanship.
Well, to me, that raises the most interesting ethical question of this, which I've seen people kind of balancing, you know, taking several different angles on. So, look, like you said, gamesmanship is a huge part of the sport within the sport. People are always trying to figure out other teams' signals. You always hear rumors about, I mean, there's a reason coaches are so paranoid about people being at practice. Somebody got a friend at the other school and he's going to tell them stuff. Let's just be clear. If there was something illegal that went on here, then that's another story. But do you think, let's say they've connected the dots, like he reached out to an assistant at Louisville, said, I have this information. Do you want it? And the guy said, of course we do. Is that really wrong? I mean, they didn't sabotage Wake Forest. Somebody offered it up to them. Are you really going to say no to that?
I don't think a lot of coaches would. I don't think they would.
I wouldn't think any coaches would say no to that, although the email did phrase it as he either, you know, gave or offered up, as in maybe somebody didn't take him up on the offer.
I mean, there's a lot of questions left unanswered by this, and I'm curious how much more we'll find out as this thing kind of gets poked at and prodded at further.
And I think that just adding to why it's such an amazing story is that it also comes complete with one of the best hashtags I've ever seen on the internet, which is, of course, WakeyLeaks. So I look forward to, I mean, this is, like you said, it's not the end of it. A lot of people have a lot of questions to answer. We don't know how many other ACC schools took him up on the offer. We don't even necessarily know what, you know, I've seen people say, that's amazing that Wake Forest won six games when the other teams had their game plan. We don't know that they had their full game plan. You know, they might have had known about a couple plays or something like that. So I'm fascinated to find out.
Same here. And I'm sure we'll have more details to talk about in the coming weeks.
Coaching carousel, as of today, is over. I don't believe that. I believe something else will happen, but right now...
No, the head coaching carousel is over.
Oh, sure.
There's still a lot of stuff.
Every FBS head coaching job has been filled to this point. Mike Sanford, Notre Dame's offensive coordinator, who's kind of had a meteoric rise here the last few years, gets the head coaching job at Western Kentucky, where he used to work as an assistant, I believe, under Willie Taggart.
Hey, by the way, I tweeted this out earlier. Mike Sanford, he becomes the fifth guy who was on Jim Harbaugh's initial staff at Stanford to become an FBS head coach. That is pretty remarkable. The aforementioned Willie Taggart, David Shaw, Scott Schaefer didn't last very long, DJ Durkin now at Maryland, and now, obviously, Mike Sanford. That's a pretty good run, and that doesn't include some of the other guys who were, you know, the Derek Masons, the Brian Polians, who were also worked under him but came later.
And there's some, like Tim Drevno, who might be a head coach soon. You know, like there could be even more. So it's reminds me of, you know, you see those pictures of like some of the old Hayden Fry staffs that had Bill Snyder and Barry Alvarez and Stoops was playing for him, and then the Bill Snyder coaching tree, you know.
Well, I mean, Leach's first team at Texas Tech, there was a lot of guys on that, including players now, because Cliff Kingsbury was one of his quarterbacks. But I mean, even Dave Aranda was a GA at Texas Tech on that, you know, on those early days. So it's interesting to see. Sometimes it's like these, you know, it's not like these teams, you know, Stanford was a really bad team that year. Obviously, Texas Tech was I want to say like a 7-5 team. But sometimes those are the ones which have like a great launch point for big coaching careers.
So let's just assume it is over. Every job has been filled. Give me your nominee for best coaching hire. Like, you think this was the one that the school got most right. And then I don't want to say worst, but the one that maybe the biggest head scratcher.
I'm going to say the one that I think where they exceeded what I thought they could do, because that's the way I would say it. I like the Tom Herman hired from Houston to Texas, but the one that I think the most exceeded what I thought they would do is Jeff Brohm going to Purdue. That was the best get.
That was my answer too. Yeah.
Oh, Stu. All right, so what's your answer for worst?
Again, I'm not saying worst, but I'm a little skeptical of Luke Fickell at Cincinnati. And on the one hand, you know, it seems to make a lot of sense. He's coached and he played actually in that state. He, you know, I'm sure he is recruited heavily in Cincinnati. Maybe I can't get the weird 2011 interim season out of my head, but more it's that I thought they could have, you know, there's other guys. I mean, I thought they might have a shot at Jeff Brohm or maybe even PJ Fleck. I thought Charlie Strong would make a good fit there, but maybe USF beat them to the punch. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a better job? They're both in the same conference.
It's a better job. I mean, look how many more players are at USF. By the way, USF also, Willie Taggart left behind more than Tommy Tuberville did. I mean, you inherit Quentin Flowers. I'm not saying Quentin Flowers will be up for the Heisman next year, but he is a stud quarterback. And
how many BCS bowls has USF played in?
I mean, we're talking
how
about
how many BCS bowls has Cincinnati though. Played in?
Stu, are you really thinking that Cincinnati has a better job than USF?
I think they're equal.
I don't want to call you stupid in front of Lindsay, but I'm about to.
I think Cincinnati was possibly heading to the Big 12 a couple months ago.
Stu, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cincinnati, but I wasn't like a huge UC football fan. Nobody really was. That was back in the days when they were losing 81-0 to Penn State. Yeah, like USF is a really good job. It's in a place where there's a whole lot of recruits, but you're also kind of apathetic. Like they play at an NFL stadium. They don't have like rabid fans by any means. Cincinnati's got that cool on-campus stadium. They do pretty well for a crowd. I'm saying there's pluses and minuses to both. And I could see where Charlie Strong makes more sense at USF because of his Florida history. There's no question about that. But it's not like I think, well, of course he would take USF over Cincinnati.
The one thing I do love about our podcast is something I never would think is going to come up and piss me off turned into you and I are arguing over which is a better job, Cincinnati or USF. So
yeah,
I do appreciate that, even if I do think less of you right now.
Well, okay. What's your most questionable one?
I don't know. I mean, the Fickell one surprised me a little bit, just in that I thought they would go offense. Because usually, I mean, Tommy Tuberville's, you know, was a defensive guy, and obviously Luke is a defensive guy. I don't know. That's a questionable one. What do you think of the Lane hire at FAU? I know we talked about this a little the other day.
We talked about it on Monday because it had just gotten, maybe just broke, or I mean, it was before his press conference. I think it's good for both parties. Now, that is contingent on Lane kind of living up to his word and being a more mature head coach about this. But people are really puzzled why he would take the job. It's because nobody higher than that was offering him a job, and he needed to get back into – well, let me ask you this. I saw our friend Andy Staples was there at the press conference. And just as he did in the press conference, Lane insisted to him after the fact that this was not about wanting to be a head coach again – that he just really believes in FAU and its potential there. Do you buy that?
No,
I don't either.
I think a lot of times coaches say things at their introductory press conference where they're stretching things. I think it has potential for him. And I think, you know, look, if he can get to 8 wins there and do it without stirring things up too much, I think that's a good thing for him. You know, whether he was the offense coordinator at UCLA, LSU, or Alabama, I'm not sure he was going to be able to advance his cause to be a head coach any better than if he actually is a head coach.
No, I mean, clearly these schools are still, they're scared. They're scared off. I mean, he didn't just like struggle on the field. You remember when he got fired by the Raiders, how contentious that was? And you thought, okay, well, that's weird. That's just Al Davis being out. But then he managed to burn bridges pretty much everywhere he went after that. So, you know, he said himself, he was 31, he thought he knew what he was doing, he didn't. I'll be interested to see how the Saban influence shows up, because before he got to Alabama, it was pretty much him trying to mimic everything Pete Carroll did.
Well, what's interesting is, after the national title game last year, you know, I spent a bunch of time shadowing Lane, as it was, and we talked about...
You caused him to miss the bus.
Yeah, I don't know if it was quite that way, but okay. One of the things he said was what he had learned from Saban was, you know, he's going to delegate more. And, you know, Nick Saban clearly is hands-on with his defense, but he let Kirby Smart and now Pruitt run the defense. When Lane was the head coach at USC, I have a really distinct memory of this. which was, yeah, he was the offensive coordinator as well. But I remember they played Notre Dame the year Notre Dame went to the title game. And they hit a big play. USC was down, and they were inside maybe the five-yard line. The guy was going to score, and then he got tackled. And then USC just had a dreadful series in the red zone. And they got stoned at like the one, so they never even scored. And it was kind of a, you know, it felt like a bigger moment for Notre Dame. Like they just kind of bowed up and wouldn't let them score and all that. But, you know, you look at it and go, Lane is a really good play caller. I know guys who work with him on the offensive staff who think he is very, very, very smart and very good at scheming. But when he's trying to do all these other things, it makes it harder. And so I think the realization from him is, okay, I can't do everything. I got to, you know, even if it's what I think I'm best at, I got to let somebody else do it, because if I want to be a head coach to do that. Now, the flip side is, you go to FAU, you don't have the resources that you would at other places. I mean, his staff, they don't have a huge budget. I mean, I know he's getting to make $950,000 himself, which is a pay cut from where he was making. But he's probably going to have a very young staff to surround himself with. So you would think he would have to be a little more involved than he might want to be, just because of, you know, this is still his program.
Now, you mentioned, obviously, now the coaching carousel kind of shifts to coordinators, and there's only really one I want to get into, because everybody, you know, Ed Orgeron was targeting Lane Kiffin. That's not a possibility. So now he hired Matt Canada from Pittsburgh, and people are making a really big deal out of this. I don't know much about Matt Canada. Why is this such a great hire for LSU?
Well, I think, you know, look, there was one guy, one offensive coordinator who made it to the Broyles finals, and it was Matt Canada. I had done a story on him a couple of months ago. When you looked at what he has done there, was very, very impressive. I mean, we'll start with this. So the ACC has the best group of quarterbacks in college football this year. Agree? I mean, it's not even close in my mind, right?
Yeah.
You got Lamar Jackson, won the Heisman. Deshaun Watson, you know, came in second. You have a guy in Mitch Trubisky, who a lot of people think might be the first quarterback taken. And further down the list, you got Brad Kaya from Miami. And that's just a few of, you know, it's a very strong group. It was Peterman, you know, the Tennessee castoff, who actually led the ACC in quarterback rating and had a 26-6 touchdown interception ratio, and that was under Matt Canada. I mean, that's quite a testament, because I mean, there's a lot of people who couldn't even tell you who Pitt's receivers are. Yeah, they know who James Conner is, but after that, it starts getting really, really fuzzy. You know, when I had talked to people at LSU yesterday, because they basically spent the day with him, they just were very impressed by how innovative he is at game planning and doing some of the things he's able to do.
Well, that was a weird year. Wisconsin, actually, that was his only season at Wisconsin in 2012, and they actually struggled most of the season. They got into the Big Ten title game at, I think, 7-5, because Ohio State and Penn State were ineligible, and then just had that, like you said, like Melvin Gordon, they just exploded on Nebraska, and I think that's the first time people really noticed him. He was at NIU for a year before that, but he didn't really do anything at NC State, right? I mean, I guess he coached Jacoby Brissett, put him in the NFL.
Yeah, they put up some big numbers.
I'm looking at a rather unflattering chart of his total yards and yards per game rank in all of his stops. This Pitt offense was 48th.
Who was the quarterback at Wisconsin that year, by the way?
Ooh, good question.
That was the year they had three different quarterbacks. Kurt Phillips, one-time Maryland darling Danny O'Brien, and Joel Stave.
There you go. And Stave probably was the one that came and rescued them.
Yeah, so.
I mean, I'll take your word for it. I mean, look, Pitt beat two top five teams this year. They went and won at Clemson in a very high-scoring game. So I do think that he's done some impressive things. And LSU, that's what they want. They want innovative after things went in a rut with Les Miles. One last SEC-related item, actually, we didn't get to. Jarrett Stidham, the Baylor grad transfer who sat out this year, headed to Auburn. And this, to me, feels like one of those really big impact grad transfers, because if we've talked about Auburn so many times, quarterback's been an issue for 2 years now. you know, you still don't really feel particularly great. I know you like Sean White, but, you know, he's not Russell Wilson either. Stidham played a few games. Remember, he came in when Seth Russell got hurt as a true freshman. I actually remember that game very vividly because we were on set that night for a live countdown to kickoff afterward. So he makes his debut as a true freshman against Kansas State, tears it up, and then played a couple more games, and then he got hurt. I guess what Auburn fans are kind of looking forward to is something I hadn't really thought of. When you think of Baylor and quarterbacks, you think passing, but he can actually run the ball too.
Yeah, I mean, he is a very good athlete. I mean, he's proven. He's got 3 years left. I mean, I would argue that of all the quarterbacks who are available out there, and that includes grad transfers, he has by far the most upside. And, you know, Auburn, that's the biggest recruit of any player, I think, that's going to get signed this month of these JC guys. Because as we're taping this, you know, this is the first day that junior college players can sign.
Yep, and between that and Cameron Pettaway saying he's coming back next season, you know, Auburn fans have a lot to be excited about there. Now we know where he's going. Does Malik Zaire become the next great free agent?
I don't know about great, but he comes the next big free agent.
The most sought after, yeah.
Let me ask you this. Do you think Malik Zaire is a bigger get than Anu Solomon? Anu Solomon's actually done more.
Well, he has, but he's had this weird career trajectory where he was most impressive as a freshman and actually led them to the Pac-12 title game.
Yeah, he hasn't been able to stay healthy.
But even when he has been healthy, you know, they were terrible this year as an offense. So
I'm going to defend Anu Solomon on this because he was banged up most of the year. And when he played in games, he didn't even practice. He was healthy for maybe at the start of the year, and that's it. I mean, let me run this by you and you tell me how you feel about it. So in Anu Solomon's first 2 years as a player, as a quarterback there, he led them to the Pac-12 title game, and his TD to interception ratio is 48-14. That's pretty good for you to be shitting on him, Stu.
Hey, Lindsay, how do we get the explicit tag on iTunes? Like, what do you have to do to earn that? Because I feel like Bruce has earned it at this point.
I think Stu needs to wear a vest with no shirt while he does the podcast. That would get us explicit.
I think I can just add it. I don't know if it's really like a badge of honor, though.
I don't know if it would like scare people off or if we would just get like an edgier new audience.
I love the idea that Stu will go back to his high school reunion at the Kevin Youkilis High School somewhere in his beloved Cincinnati. And people are like, hey, there's Stu Mandel, the guy who has the explicit podcast. Who would have known that was coming?
I think you're right about Anu Solomon's first two seasons. This year, in limited action, 58% completions, one touchdown, two interceptions. I guess you'll be able to tell by what level schools these guys end up at. I mean, I know Zaire is being sought after by
Pitt,
UNC. UNC is after him. But I felt like Anu Solomon's going to end up at Hawaii or something like that.
I could definitely see that Nick Rolovich, you know, taking him and him thinking, you know, he has Hawaii roots. Maybe they go back there.
Yeah. All right. Enough of us babbling. You guys have sent so many great emails. We want to go email heavy here. So, Lindsay, just cue up the sound effect there because it's mailbag time.
It's the mailbag from a computer. So not literally a bag, but just mail.
Gosh, this is like a whole new recording experience. We're hearing this the same time you guys are.
Yes. Hey, before we get into this quick, we had our Fox Sports College Football All-America team for the season. Anyone there who you really pushed for and yet, you know, because there were four of us who voted, didn't make it?
You caught me a little off guard there. Hold on. I tabulated it very quickly.
Lindsay, I'm going to take that as Stu saying, you know what? I'm the one who tabulated the votes. I got whatever I wanted. You guys have no idea how the other two guys voted.
That was the unofficial tiebreaker. If there were two or three guys with the same votes, I just went with the one I like. No, I'll give you actually a really good the opposite, though. Not somebody I pushed for. All three of you guys had Cam Robinson on your first team, and I didn't have him on either the first or second team. I know that may seem strange because he won the Outland, but I'd heard at times, you know, from various people that he wasn't having that great a year. And you know, I think a couple of us leaned pretty heavily on Pro Football Focus for this because you could tell by some of the names of the offensive linemen that kept coming up.
So you had Forrest Lamp in there?
I did. From Western Kentucky. But he didn't ever really show up on their grades of the highest rated offensive linemen. Here's an interesting one for you. I'm glad you brought this up, actually. Cody O'Connell from Washington State. This kind of reinforces my point that I'm not sure sports writers should be picking the offensive linemen for any all-conference or all-American team. The Pac-12 coaches team, he was honorable mention all Pac-12. He is a unanimous, including on ours, first team All-American. Why the discrepancy?
I'll tell you two things. You mentioned Pro Football Focus. They love Cody O'Connell, and I will tell you why I voted for him. I spent a couple of days in Pullman, and I know the O-line coach there loves Cody O'Connell too and told me why he thinks he's so good. So I'm gonna stick with that one. Like, if I can talk to a coach or certainly a position coach about their player, and they give me some, especially if it's an O-line thing, I feel pretty good about it now. Because I don't know, it's a hard deal. I mean, Aaron Taylor, who I used to work with, is, you know, knows more about NFL off, knows more about O-line play than anybody who's at a keyboard and covers college football. You know, he does his Joe Moore Award. He's part of a panel that rates offensive linemen. And it's like, it's hard. You can't see every snap. If a guy gives up what seems like two sacks in a game, and maybe it's not his fault, maybe somebody else blew a assignment, or maybe a back wasn't where he's supposed to be. You know, we think the guy stinks, and, or, you know, thinks the guy have an awful game. That's not to absolve you from snubbing Cam Robinson one way or the other. Or it's just like, you know, that's why it's tricky. It's a lot easier, I feel like, to make a case for skill guys than it is on the O-line front.
The O-line is just, I don't feel comfortable picking them at all. I'd also like to start a movement with All-American teams to modernize them a little bit. We had a situation where, you know, I went into it, gave you guys the instruction and everything to do two defensive ends and two defensive tackles. The problem is, you don't want to leave off any of the three of Derek Barnett, Jonathan Allen, and Myles Garrett. I saw some people listing Jonathan Allen as a defensive tackle. Not on their official depth charts and everything else, he's listed as a defensive end, and I think he mostly plays defensive end, but he does move inside a little bit.
And that brings up the point that...
Well, yeah, and same with Christian Wilkins at Clemson. I just think the sport... Jabril Peppers is not the only player in the country that plays multiple positions, and I think we need to start being a little bit more flexible and less rigid about, you know... Myles Garrett shouldn't have to, be schlepped down to the second team because you're being so strict about ends versus tackles. I mean, to me, the four clear guys were Barnett, Allen, Ed Oliver, and Garrett.
Here's the problem with you. You're saying we need to be more flexible. You're the one who created the rules for us on this one. You were like, I want this. I mean, here well, I am. No,
but I relaxed it.
Ethan Posick, who played center but can play a bunch of different places, I'm trying to get him at guard because I want to have him and still have Tyler Orlovsky from West Virginia on my list. But you're so rigid. I don't know how your wife lives with you, actually.
It's a character attack. I loosened the rules once you guys submitted your votes and I realized that it was going to be a little harder to be so rigid. All right. Let's do this mailbag. Lots of people had lots of good emails. This one actually is from Lieutenant Colonel Patrick J. Kendall of the U.S. Air Force. It's mid-December, and all FBS head coach jobs are filled. Stewart tweeted that someone will jump to the NFL starting the cycle again. I do believe that. I don't know if he'd go, but why wouldn't an NFL team reach out to Chris Peterson? Seems like his style would be one of the few that could do well at the next level. Thanks for the outstanding podcast. Thank you for your service.
Yes, thank you, Patrick, for your service and for your nice email and for making what I think is a very good point. I'm not sure why an NFL team wouldn't reach out to Chris Peterson. I think he would be one that makes a lot of sense. You know, I woke up this morning, I saw Peter King had reported that, you know, I think there were three names he had mentioned that were potentially upward mobile this cycle. One was Mike McIntyre, who, by the way, was, you know, a Bill Parcells guy with the Cowboys, has NFL experience. Another one was Dan Mullen, who has, you know, a quarterback who's opened a lot of eyes there this year in, you know, certainly in Dak Prescott. You know, he'd also mentioned David Shaw, and David Shaw had no interest. And the third name was Paul Chryst, who we both agree has done a terrific job at Wisconsin. And, you know, I could see Paul Chryst style playing in the NFL as well.
That's a good point about Dan Mullen. You know, you could just see the NFL is such kind of an overreaction league. They'd be like, wow, this guy is the guy who coached Dak Prescott. We need to hire him. And that would be fine, but it would be ironic because Dan Mullen has tried so hard to get out of Mississippi State. He's tried for so many different college jobs and never gotten them. Wouldn't it be something if he then gets an NFL head coaching job?
Yeah, I know. And I'm very curious now. Of the names out there, and I think we had maybe kicked this around the other day on the podcast, or maybe we kicked it around offline. I don't even remember. The one name I could say I would be curious if somebody in the NFL made a run at, because there's been interest in him before, is James Franklin. You know, he had interest in the Texans job, like I want to say 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, I got to stop you here. We've joked in the past about your man crush on Scooby, right, a couple years ago. This year, your man crush is clearly James Franklin. You're always tweeting about Coach of the Year. You brought it up on here. I saw you were very mad. I don't even know which Coach of the Year award it is. They left him out of the final. Of course he should be a finalist for Coach of the Year. Now you want to ship him off to the NFL?
No,
what's going on?
I don't want to ship him off to the NFL. I'm saying, who do I think would have a shot if the NFL were going to look at? I would think they would look at him.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
By the way, I'm glad you brought it up. Scooby Wright, I think, is reunited back home now with the Arizona Cardinals. So that's very cool, right?
That's great.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad he's making it.
You mentioned man crushes. Who'd you own up to having a man crush who's college football related this year?
That's a great question. Oh, Jazz Peavy. I love the name most of all, but he's also like, I love the fact that we think Wisconsin traditionally, right? You think kind of slow and plodding. And all of a sudden, this guy will just flash across the screen for 40, 50-yard gain. Love Jazz Peavy.
Okay. Any coach?
So in other words, somebody who I'm like disproportionately higher on than everybody else?
Yes.
Sorry, I got nobody. I got nobody. Nobody comes to mind.
You know who I thought you were going to say?
Who?
I thought you were going to say Kyle Whittingham.
I have a standing man crush on Kyle Whittingham, who I just saw the other day, actually. Like, he's one of my favorites. He's always been one of my favorites. It's not unique to this year.
Yes. Okay. From Quincy Bailey in Frankfort, Ohio. This Alabama team appears to be on track to do what no other team has done. Go 15-0, minus a somewhat close game versus Ole Miss. No one has come close to beating them, just as Nebraska rolled through the Big Eight. So are we watching greatness? But I don't get as excited about this Alabama team as I did that Nebraska team. Is it the lack of flashy Heisman contender like Tommy Frazier? Or maybe because back then I was a wide-eyed 20-year-old and now I'm a cynical 41-year-old. Sounds a little like my podcast colleague, by the way, Quincy. Would like to know y'all's thoughts. Also, with a win, will West Virginia be the lowest-ranked 11-win team from a major conference ever? Stu, that's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that second one. You know, I think we always are nostalgic, right? And like, he and I are almost the same age. I'm 1 year younger. And we're always nostalgic. Like, for me, peak college football will always be like 1995, like right around there, 1995-ish. So, of course, I have like a special affinity for the Tommy Frazier Nebraska team. Before we even get into this, you see what we're doing here? This is exactly what happened to our guy Matt Leinart's USC team. Everybody wants to build you up into the greatest of all time before you've actually finished the job. Just setting up for a Ohio State, Clemson, maybe Washington upset over Alabama, and all of us hearing about how we, because you know what will happen if Alabama loses. All we're going to hear is how we, the media, overhyped Alabama. So I just want to throw that caveat out there that I'm not ready to say Alabama is the greatest team of all time or anything close to it yet. They got to finish the job. But I think he's got a point. Usually the teams we think of as the great teams have a Heisman contending quarterback or running back or like one superstar defensive player who's so much better than the others. And Alabama's just not like that. I don't want to say they're not a flashy offense because they're running a similar offense now to most teams in terms of Jalen Hurts running the spread. But yeah, they're not as glamorous on that side of the ball. And defensively, I actually find their defense to be more exciting than in years past because there's always the possibility they're going to score a touchdown. I mean, they're constantly, seems like, returning fumbles or block kicks or whatnot. So it's not like a bore you to death kind of like some of his old teams. But I know I get what he's saying. This is not the kind of team that people, you know, just rally around because there's not – I can't see people around the country, like kids around the country are going to run out and buy Jalen Hurts jerseys just yet.
Yeah, what I'd be curious, and somebody else can do the math on this, obviously this has not been a great year for the SEC, overall. So I think dominating the SEC this year may not carry as much weight as it would have in years past, you know, if you want to do it historically. And I think this is clearly the best team in the country right now, but they beat Ole Miss, who's proved to be a 5-7 Ole Miss team. They beat them by 5 points. They beat LSU only by 10, and that game was very tight going into the fourth quarter, and that's only a 7-4 LSU team. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, in retrospect, the most impressive win on their resume was the one that happened in the beginning of the year when they crushed USC, and obviously USC wasn't very good at that time. So what am I saying here?
Yeah, how they do in the playoff is going to shape everybody's image of them ultimately.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Ohio State team 2 years ago gained almost all of their respect from the run they made in the playoff. Ezekiel Elliott, we've talked about, was an honorable mention All Big Ten player that year who exploded in the postseason. But just in case you are going to make these historical comparisons, everybody, let me run through 95 Nebraska real quick. Beat Oklahoma State 64-21, Michigan State 50-10, Arizona State 77-28. Pacific, how about that? Pacific appearing on the schedule, 49-7. Washington State 35-21, Missouri 57-0, number 8 Kansas State 49-25, number 7 Colorado 44-21, Iowa State 73-14, number 10 Kansas, that's right, at number 10 Kansas, Glenn Mason there, 41-3, Oklahoma 37-0, and of course number 2 Florida 62-24. I don't know if we'll ever see that again.
No, I don't think so. And by the way, just to finish up with what Quincy had asked, he's got a good point because of the West Virginia factor. Because you now that we teams are playing more games, so you'll have a chance to get to 11. But just looking in the last 3 years, there hasn't been a Power Five. Louisville, back when Charlie Strong was there, was 11-1, but that was and they finished 18th. But Louisville wasn't in the ACC at that time. So you'd have a lot of teams that were like 10-2, which, you know, to find an 11-win team, I mean, I've already gone back to 2012, and, well, actually, I stand corrected. In 2012, Florida State, 11-2, won the Orange Bowl, finished 12th.
Huh. You wouldn't expect that. I guess that was the lack of respect for the NIU win in the Orange Bowl. I don't know how much credit West Virginia is going to get for beating Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of stunned to see that. I mean, I'm glad we kind of cleared that up just because, you know, I wouldn't have believed if I didn't see it either. But now that, you know, we're pointing it out. Yeah, that's true. All right, Stu, next.
Bruce and Stuart, with the coaching carousel mostly stopped, I have to ask, what happened to PJ Fleck? A month ago, he was the hottest up-and-comer not named Tom Herman, yet he's still at Western Michigan, and media reports made it seem like he wasn't even particularly close to grabbing any of the open gigs. Keep up the good work. Joseph Sura.
You know what? I'm not sure anything really happened to PJ Fleck other than, you know, there was interest in him from Purdue, I'm told, and he wasn't that fired up about it. You know, he's got young kids, a bunch of them, and he likes it there. He and his new wife are pretty comfortable in Kalamazoo. He's not going to just jump at a job just to take a job. I was told, and I think we reported this a couple of weeks ago, that the scenario where he'd be kind of like Tom Herman was last year, and Herman passed up some pretty good jobs, but not great jobs, albeit, you know, South Carolina, to stay at Houston for another year. They boosted his deal considerably, and then he figured, all right, let's see what happens a year later. I think PJ Fleck's in the same situation. Now, I think one thing that's kind of happened a little bit is I think maybe we in the media probably overinflated his opportunities a little bit. The idea that you would, you know, at 35, you'd be able to parlay a MAC job into an Oregon seemed a little bit of a stretch. I mean, as we said before, I know you and I have talked about this. Last year's hot coach in the MAC was Matt Campbell, really good coach. He ended up with Iowa State. The difference between Iowa State jobs and Oregon is pretty significant. So I think maybe that was kind of something where we probably got over our skis a little bit.
Well, and to give you credit, you kept reminding people of that, even as I and others were saying, well, why not? Why not Oregon? You kept saying that might be too big a jump from the MAC. I wonder how much his opportunities next year at this time will be tied to whether they beat Wisconsin in this bowl game, because Tom Herman didn't truly become the hot coach of the moment until, you know, they were 12-1, but it wasn't until they beat Florida State in the bowl game that just kind of took off. So, I mean, PJ Fleck is getting a lot of acclaim. There's no question about that. But if they get run off the field by Wisconsin in the Cotton Bowl, then people might say, well, he was just feasting on mediocre competition. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, good point. I'm up next to, before we get to Brian's question, I wanted to follow up on something. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago you asked me about what happens if somehow Spencer Tillman gets food poisoning, and does Brando take over both roles, or what do they do in the emergency case?
Yeah, that was a great email. You got an answer?
Yeah, I got an answer. So it is kind of what you said, which is the radio guy who is, if they're connected, if there is no one, and I guess this has happened with baseball quite a bit, and maybe some basketball, would be brought in to try to handle it. Now, in the case of, because I asked my producer this, I said, what would happen if, with our crew, if let's say, Tim got really, really, really bad food poisoning and couldn't go on the air, Spencer, I guess I would move up to the booth and Spencer and I would handle it that way. And Spencer's certainly adept at doing it. And it would be that way. But otherwise, the fallback, I guess, is the radio announcer.
Would he then not call the game for the radio, or it would just become like a simulcast?
It would be a simulcast. That's what they had told me, that it would be a simulcast. I'm glad you added that.
I'm glad we got that answer.
All right. So Brian's question, who pays for these student athletes to travel to the various award ceremonies? Is it the school they represent, the various award trusts, the athletes, or all of the above? You guys do great work. Thank you, Brian. In the case of these are the award ceremonies that foot the bill. One thing I'm a little unclear of is, remember a few years ago with, I remember it came up because of, Cedric Ovoye and the insurance deal that, schools can pick up the tab for, and it's out of a fund that also that fund covers, like, let's say, Austin Carr is going to Big Ten Media Days and, Northwestern can pick up the tab for his suits, to go do that. And that's part of that fund. Now, I know it had gotten kicked around on Twitter because of Lamar Jackson. Somebody had pointed out what looked like Lamar Jackson's tux from the other day was on sale at Macy's. I don't think the Heisman or, in the case of the award show I did the other night, the Lott Award or whatever, is picking up the tab for the players' clothes. I think the schools will handle that if the players need the help. But otherwise, it's on the award ceremonies to fly them up and put them wherever they want to be put up.
Correct. And in fact, Andrea Adelson from ESPN had a fantastic all-access story where she was kind of embedded with Lamar Jackson throughout his, starting at the award ceremony in Atlanta through the Heisman. And there were a lot of interesting details in there I didn't realize, including the fact I had no idea this was the case. The player who wins the Heisman that night upgrades them to a suite at the Marriott Marquis. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. Does Johnny come along with the suite to his entertainment, or how does that work?
Yeah, like Johnny, not only did he show up at the Heisman, he started showing up in all of Lamar Jackson's pictures. And then apparently part of her story actually is about how he got a little annoyed because then he went on Dan Patrick, and Dan Patrick wanted to ask him about Johnny Manziel. TMZ shoved a camera in his face and wanted to ask him about Johnny Manziel. If I'm Lamar Jackson, I'd be pretty annoyed about that too. Like, stop stealing my thunder.
The gift that keeps on giving, the Downtown Athletic Club.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and ask the next question. It's from Will Sherritt here in Spokane, Washington. I work in TV and radio in town and listen to every podcast. Keep up the great work. Thank you, Will. I cover Bruce's boy, Mike Leach, always entertaining. And with the news about Deshaun Kizer, I realized it turning pro. I realized it paves the way for one of Bruce's other guys, Brandon Wimbush, to see the field next year.
Brandon, look, Deshaun Kizer is really talented. Got a big arm, everything, really smart. Brandon Wimbush has an electric arm too. I mean, that thing, the ball just jumps out of his hand. When he was at the Elite 11 the year he was there, he, on paper, he should be a terrific quarterback. He can really run fast. He's got a really powerful arm. He's a very, very, very smart kid. And I mean, the thing I heard about Kizer from the Notre Dame guys a couple of weeks ago or 10 days ago was he's extremely football smart and he's very intuitive and those things. I don't know if Brandon's that. I know Brandon is very school smart, And we'll see how it picks up, because there are some guys who, and I'm not saying he's not this way, but there are some guys who are very, you know, academically smart, and yet football-wise, they don't process as quickly. We'll see how Brandon does. We'll see if, you know, how his touch is. I know they like also, you know, he mentioned Leach. Leach had a quarterback committed for a while, Ian Book, who Notre Dame ended up getting to decommit and taking. And I know they like him too, but I mean, clearly I think it's going to be Brandon's show, and I expect him to be really good. Now, what I think hurt Notre Dame's offense is they really had one receiver, it felt like. You know, hopefully for them, they will get their tight end, you know, eligible and back. He certainly would be a big weapon for them, but they were limited. They had one guy, and so I expect Brandon to have a really strong year, but I think they're going to miss not having Mike Sanford there. We'll see who they hire to replace him, but he, you know, he was a good sounding board for those quarterbacks.
Just to be clear from before, you don't think there was any scenario where now that Kaiser's turning pro, Zaire stays in Notre Dame?
I would doubt it, because I think he probably knew Deshaun was leaving anyway.
I think he'll be a good pickup for somebody. So, and we're going to hit a lull next week, the holiday lull, if you will. So I think only one podcast next week as we get into holiday season. And then next thing you know, after Christmas, you and I both head to our respective playoff sites. As always, if you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And tell 10 of your friends while you're at it. Send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.